Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, September 2nd, 2026, September, on 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is yet still doing election stuff. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show another time, you can check out our podcasts at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at FransDorchND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Okay, just a little bit longer for antibiotics, still taking herbs, still feeling pretty good. I get tired at the end of the day, but it's normal tired. It's not crushing tired. I seem to be doing all right. The discomfort in my leg is up and down. I'm holding off. I'm calling the neurosurgeon. My plan is to get in the water and see if water therapy helps me. And I'm going to go a whole bunch of weeks in a row getting a lot of PT and chiropractic and acupuncture. So I'm looking forward to all of that. We'll see how that goes. I'm still hanging in there. Some days are worse than others. Today was not bad. Yesterday was a worse day, and today I feel a bit better. So that's kind of good. So we'll see if it's possible to have spinal stenosis and have the pain be minimized with general management. One of the things I did today that probably helped is I did my full series of day one of my PT exercises, and I felt better after that. Go figure. And tomorrow I intend to get up in the morning and do my day two of my PT exercises. And if I get up early enough, I get to do the PT exercises followed by some gentle yoga. So we'll do that. And after I make the show, I'm going to do some gentle yoga. Yay, gentle yoga. All about the gentle yoga. And then we'll do cardio over the weekend. So that'll be cool. All right. So let me talk to you about things that you're interested in. If you happen to be listening and if you happen to be watching on Facebook Live, please go ahead and tell me that you're here and ask questions. Right now, I'm not seeing that there's anybody listening, but if you jump on, you can go ahead and ask me questions. I'll keep checking to see if somebody's listening. And if so, I'll encourage you to ask me questions. And I'd be happy to answer a question that you ask me on the spot. So meanwhile, let's talk about at-home Lyme tick tests. So that's a thing that you can get. There's a tick test that you can get at home. What you have to do is you have to, when you take the tick off you or a loved one, you have to keep it. When you get the tick, you have to either put it in a vial. I'm not sure if you put it in a vial for this kit. I don't know if they want you, because usually when you grab a tick and you're going to take it to be tick tested at a lab, they want you to put it in a little bit of alcohol, of isopropyl rubbing alcohol. And I don't know that this kit wants you to do that. There's a test called Lyme Alert, and I don't think it's the only tick-borne illness test, and this should not be construed as I'm telling you to get this. There's pre-orders. It's not generally available yet, but apparently you can order it. This home-use tick testing kit is designed to help individuals determine whether a removed tick may carry the pathogen that can cause Lyme disease. The test analyzes the tick itself to provide rapid insight following a tick bite and support informed decision making. The test gives you results in less than 30 minutes. You test the tick, not the person or the pet. It's designed for early detection. It's easy to use. No lab visits or waiting, and you can use it at home, and it's portable. You can travel with it, and it's built by medical and scientific experts. You're able to do it at home or, you know, wherever you happen to be. So the first thing you do is you remove and save the tick, and it doesn't say what to put it in. I guess you just save it. Save it in a little vial or something, or save it in some kind of a container. And then you test the tick at home, and you get results, whether it's just like the COVID test. You put it in, and if the tick is positive for Lyme disease, then it'll show a red band. And you get the results very quickly. So the thing is, I had an interesting conversation once with Dr. Dardick. And so Dr. Dardick's feeling was that he's not sure how valuable testing a tick is, because even if you know that the tick is positive, you still don't know if you are positive. But I think it gives you more options. If the tick is negative, then you can rest easy and you can be like, well, I guess I don't need to treat myself. But it depends. I'm not clear if this test only tests for Lyme disease, because we know that ticks carry co-infections. They can carry Babesia, they can carry Ehrlichia, they can carry Bartonella, they can carry Powassan virus, they can carry Mycoplasma, they can carry Rickettsia, Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. They can carry tick-borne relapsing fever, depending on the species. They can make you have Alpha-Gal. I believe that's the Lone Star tick that does that. So I'm not sure if this test only for Lyme. It says Lyme alert. It does not say tick-borne illness alert. So it may not test for co-infections, which is kind of concerning. So that's the thing, though. If it doesn't test positive for Lyme and it doesn't do co-infections and you feel sick, you don't know what you have. You could still have a co-infection. Anyway, so that's interesting. But the thing is, if it does test positive for Lyme disease, then you and your doctor can make a decision as to whether you're going to do prophylactic antibiotics. And if you are dealing with a holistic medicine practitioner, somebody who treats Lyme disease, like myself or like Mariah Hinchy or Marissa Hauser or any of the docs that treat tick-borne illness, they can give you other things. They can give you herbs, and there's various herbs that are promoted by the Buhner protocol, and some things that are not necessarily Buhner herbs. Like, I'm not sure if he talks about oregano oil and carvacrol, but that is definitely something that can be helpful. He talks about a lot of herbs. If you read Stephen Buhner's book, there's so many herbs that are helpful for the various tick-borne illnesses. So you can certainly take those, and you can, if you find out that you have been bitten by a positive tick, as soon as you can get to a natural medicine practitioner, you can start taking those things. So that, and you probably want to sit down with a practitioner who knows what they're doing to tell you what to take and how much of it to take. And then there's things you can take along with it to support your general health, things that don't necessarily just kill the tick-borne illness, but support your immune system and support detoxification. So things like your modified citrus pectin and chlorella and spirulina and milk thistle, which is a liver herb. I'm patting my liver. So there are sort of the lots of things that you can do. If you know that your tick is positive for Lyme disease, you do have more options. If you know that it's positive for Lyme disease, but you don't know if it's positive for a co-infection, that's problematic, because you still don't know if you have a co-infection. And of course, all the tick-borne illnesses can be hard to test for during basic labs, because they are, as Bill Rawl says, stealth microbes. And stealth microbes hide in low concentrations in remote parts of your body and don't necessarily float around in your bloodstream, which is why you don't see the antibodies when you do a blood test, because the stealth microbes are doing their damage inside your joints, inside your heart, inside your brain, inside your nerves, inside your digestive system. Oh, it's not good. And so you don't always see antibodies. And then a doctor will tell you, well, you don't have it. And the thing is, if I feel like somebody is symptomatic, I treat them. And of course, I can treat them with natural medicine. And I can't prescribe anything, because in the state of Connecticut, we don't have prescriptive authority. But I can encourage them to go to either their primary care physician or to urgent care labs where they're likely to treat them. So we do send people to urgent care labs where they might be more likely to treat them. So this is interesting that this is now being marketed generally. It's not terribly expensive. It's something you can get, and you can test your tick at home and you get more information. But I would say, once you test the tick, you still need to take up with a medical practitioner so you can figure out what to do about it. It's not a good idea to fly blind when you're treating tick-borne illness, because the ramifications can be very serious. You can have long-term illness. It can affect many systems in your body, and you just don't feel good, or whoever your loved one is, isn't going to feel good. So it's a good idea to have a practitioner who can help you. So that was the first thing that I wanted to talk about today. Now I wanted to talk about something interesting, and this is something that I have been engaging in myself. I'm 62 years of age, and I need to keep my brain sharp. And I think I keep my brain pretty sharp by constantly thinking about and learning natural medicine stuff, because I'm picking up stuff all the time. I'm studying all the time. I'm learning new things all the time. But one thing that I am doing is studying languages, and I'm using the very simple app Duolingo. So there are those who say that Duolingo isn't adequate because you don't get a lot of conversational experience. You do get some, and I think gradually over time you do learn how to say certain things. It's just that the way to really learn to speak a language is to immerse yourself in it. You're forced to sit down with somebody and just speak nothing but the language. And when you make mistakes, they help you. And if there's something you want to say, they help you to say it, and you have the course of a conversation. When you're using a tool like Duolingo, it's giving you what it thinks might be useful for you in certain circumstances, like Tem um parque aqui, which means there's a park here in Portuguese, or tem um teatro lá, which means there's a theater there. So, you know, there's cute things like that, and you build vocabulary over time, and you learn to read and write the language because they make you type stuff out, and they make you repeat stuff, and they make you learn new words. So at my age, my advanced age, it's good to keep my mind sharp, and specifically learning languages is good for that. So there are those who feel like they're not good with languages. I really think the only reason why people think they're not good with languages is because they didn't start learning other languages than English when they were kids. I started to pick up Yiddish words as soon as I could talk, because I heard them from my parents. And then when I was maybe six, I started learning Hebrew. I can't converse in Hebrew. I can say some things in Hebrew, like ani rotza, l'shote mayim. I want to drink water. That's a good idea. And I don't think I said that right, because I don't know the infinitive of to drink. For a woman to say drink is shota, that's she drinks. But I'm not sure what the infinitive is. So here's why learning languages can be really good for you. Speaking more than one language fluently can help you keep your brain young. If you speak more than one language fluently, it doesn't just feel like it deeply changes the brain. It does actually affect the way a person processes information, how agile the brain remains through life, and might even improve its resilience following severe illness. Several studies now show that bilingualism or multilingualism can keep the brain young, and there's some evidence for that. So when you learn more than one language, it doesn't just feel good, it brings a wealth of benefits. There are obvious ones, like being able to communicate effectively as you travel, enriching your inner life by accessing books, films, and other materials and languages in which they were originally written. Speaking more than one language fluently, however, also reshapes the brain in surprising ways. Neuroplasticity. Studies are increasingly finding that bilingual people who have native command of two languages, or multilinguals who are able to speak more than two languages, are able to maintain their brains younger and healthier for longer, and that's no coincidence. So the thing is, a lot of people in the United States they don't wind up having a need to speak more than just English, so they don't start learning it, and then they learn it in school, and what they learn in school is not enough to keep them fresh, and so they never hold on to it. I was fortunate in that I was presented with Hebrew at age six, and I started learning to read and write it then, and then I continued to study it through my teen years, and then I kept up my skills by going to synagogue and reading the Siddurim, the prayer books at synagogue. And so I know some words, but I can't sit and have a conversation. But I'm learning more conversational phrases now that I'm studying Duolingo. And then Spanish, they started teaching us Spanish when I was nine, So they started us very young. I was in New Jersey, and of course, there's a lot of Latinos in New Jersey, and they thought it would be a good idea to start teaching us Spanish. So I started learning Spanish when I was in like third grade, and they kept that up. And then when I got to middle school, you had a choice of taking class in either Spanish or French, and I chose Spanish. And so I continued to study Spanish. And then when I got to high school, I focused on Spanish. In high school, you had more options. You could take French, you could take German, and I think you could take Latin. But I just stuck with Spanish, and I took Spanish right up through high school. So I finished with Spanish 5 at the end of high school. And then I minored in Spanish in college. And then I wound up having a Cuban boyfriend. And after that, a Mexican friend who I practiced with. So that helped me to become nearly fluent. I mean, I can carry on a conversation in Spanish. So that made me pretty much bilingual. I'm not bilingual enough to like recognize if you showed me a movie in Spanish, it would be hard for me to keep up. But if people speak slowly, I can pretty much get the gist of what everybody's saying. And, you know, when a Spanish-speaking patient comes in, I can converse with them pretty much. And I find that I know way, way more in Spanish than the other languages that I'm learning. So I decided I was going to learn French because I have my Canadian citizenship and I had never learned French. So I'm studying French now. And I knew some French words. Everybody knows merci beaucoup and, you know, parlez-vous français. I knew that. But, I learned more stuff like comment ça va, you know, how's it going? Ça va bien. Ça va très bien. Merci. And how are you? It's going. How are you doing? And you say it's going well. You say basically you say how's it going for how are you, and you say it's going well. Comment tu t'appelles? What's your name? And you know, stuff like that. Voudrais un croissant et un café. I'd like a croissant and a coffee. You know, I could say stuff like that. And then I decided on Portuguese because Portuguese is really pretty. And I have some Brazilian friends. I do have a friend I can speak French with who'd be happy to tutor me in French. And then I have friends from Brazil who would be happy to tutor me in Portuguese. And then I decided to study Italian as well. And if you speak Spanish, French and Portuguese, you have to really learn the pronunciation. The pronunciation is much different than Spanish and than in English. So you have to learn bonjour, you know, bom dia, boa tarde, you know, all the consonants and vowels are mushy in Portuguese. It's a very sexy language. And in French, you know, there's a lot of nasal stuff that happens. It's a little bit of that nasal stuff that happens in Portuguese too. But Spanish is very phonetic, and the consonants and vowels have basically one sound. And so you're not extending sounds, and they're not, you don't have so much of that je sound, depending on what country you're from. In Argentina, they say ellos, but they don't do a lot of that in Spanish, nor in Italian. Italian and Spanish are similar in that if you speak Spanish, I think it's easier to pronounce Italian because there's no, there's not a lot of those lazy long vowels and consonants. So I'm finding, and because, you know, I'm studying mostly Romance languages, they have, a lot of the words are similar. They're similar and some of them are absolutely the same. There's words in Portuguese and Spanish that are exactly the same. Aqui, for here. Let's see. Por favor is please in both languages. Si is yes in both Spanish and Italian, but in Portuguese it's sing, and it's spelled S-I-M, but the M is pronounced like N-G. So you're almost saying sing, like sing a song. So the final M's are pronounced that way, tambien, which means also, and which is very similar to tambien. Anyway, so the thing is, this is good exercise for my brain. And it's going to help my neuroplasticity and help my brain to continue to develop. So speaking more than one language fluently helps to reshape the brain in surprising ways. Bilingual people who have native command of two languages or multilinguals who are able to speak more than two languages are able to maintain their brains younger and healthier for longer. So the other thing is, if you grow up in a place where you're expected to speak numerous languages, like take Trevor Noah, for example, he grew up in South Africa. And in South Africa, you're going to speak English And then you're probably going to, speak Afrikaans, which is the, the Dutch took over South Africa. And there's a language that's a mixture of some of the local African languages, as well as the, as the original Dutch. So he probably speaks Afrikaans, and then he speaks native languages, and he speaks at least two. And I think Trevor Noah speaks seven languages. So he speaks Xhosa. So it's got the X, that's a click sound. And I'm pretty sure he speaks Zulu as well, which would be useful in South Africa. And then he speaks a few more native languages. So you'll find that, if you live in Spain, you probably speak English, because the lingua franca, which means the language that everybody speaks to communicate with each other, is English. Lots of people in Europe speak English because Americans come visit, and it's become the lingua franca of choice. The lingua franca used to be French. So if you went to the UN, everybody spoke French. That was the language everybody learned. And that's not so true anymore. Now everybody learns English. So if you're in Spain, you probably speak, if you're Spanish, you probably speak English. You certainly speak Spanish. And then you probably speak your local language too. So if you're Basque, you probably speak Basque. If you're from Catalonia, you speak Catalonian. And if you're from Valencia, you speak Valencian. And if you're from Barcelona, I forget what the local language there is. It's one of those, Catalonian, or there's one I'm not thinking of, but there's Valencian, there's Catalonian, and there's Basque, and there's other dialects in Spain that are local. So it's not enough that you have to learn Spanish. There's local dialects too. And if you're in Ireland, you're going to be learning, you're probably speaking English and you're probably speaking Gaelic. So, yeah, so there's lots of places. And then if you live in Holland, I remember when I went to visit Amsterdam, I was with my partner at the time, and we walked into a store, and the gentleman greeted us in Dutch, and we looked at him with, like, he had two heads, and he said, "Oh, spraken Sie Deutsch?" And we said, "No." And he said, "Parlez-vous français?" And we said, "No." He said, "Do you speak English?" And we said, "Yes." And then he tended to us in English. So he spoke at least Dutch, German, French, and English, which is very useful if you're in Amsterdam, because you're very close to Belgium, and which is not that far from France. So people who French-speaking people are going to come over all the time. Dutch and Flemish are very similar to each other. So you got Belgium covered, and then Germany, I may border on the Netherlands, I'm not sure, but German people come in. So he speaks German. And then of course everybody speaks English, and people come from Great Britain. It's very easy for people to come from Great Britain to the Netherlands, because it's right there. There's a strait in between, Great Britain and the Netherlands. And there are ferries that go back and forth. So people are coming from Great Britain all the time. And of course, Americans come as well. So you're going to have people, when people live in Europe, they often speak many languages, because the countries are the size of states. So learning more languages is a good idea. In this country, if people have backgrounds from other places, you might have Italian people speaking Italian. You certainly have Latinos speaking Spanish, and you have First Nation people speaking their native languages. And then you have some people who don't learn, that they all they speak is English. So you do have some bilingualism, multilingualism in the U.S. And when you get into the Midwest, the Northern Midwest, you have people who speak Hmong. I had no idea that there were so many people that of the Hmong people, which is an ethnicity from various places in Asia. And there was a Suni Lee was a gymnast, and she's Hmong. And so that's another language that's largely spoken by Asians in the Midwest. Who knew? Anyway, so speaking more than one language is good for you. When you learn new languages and recall words and grammatical structures from different language sets, Your brains are constantly being exercised and forming fresh connections. That leads to not just to a kind of rejuvenation of brain cell networks, but also to, get this, improved resilience, even when the brain is challenged by exposure to viruses and disease. So there's some latest, some recent research. So learning languages helps you with your immune system. Go figure. So first, how does the human brain recall different languages? Two scientists from NYU set out to find out in 2025 and conducted a study whose findings they later published in the Journal of Neuroscience. So Xuanxi Jessica Chen, who's a doctoral researcher in psychology, and Esti Blanco Elorrieta, who's a PhD, who's an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience, worked with 23 Spanish-English bilingual speakers, 17 females, 5 males, and 1 non-binary participant, and they were ages 18 to 45 years, to investigate where languages spoken with equal proficiency reside in the brain and how bilinguals retrieve them. One of the remarkable things about bilinguals is they can switch between languages that often use very different words and sounds, said Blanco Elorrieta, who was... they wanted to understand whether the brain uses separate mechanisms for each language and whether it can reuse the same underlying machinery across languages. The scientists use magnetoencephalography, also known as MEG, to track the brain activity of study participants in minute detail while they engaged in translation exercises between the two languages. Then they looked at what happened in participants' brains when they worked with cognates, which are similar words with similar meanings across the two languages, and pseudo-words, made-up words that followed syntactic and syllable structures common in both Spanish and English. What the researchers found was that the brain appears to have a language-general computational mechanism. That means that there's a single engine or language headquarters extracting meaning across different languages. We found that when bilinguals adjusted words to fit a grammatical context, for example, changing a singular noun into a plural noun, the same pattern of brain activity appeared across both English and Spanish. This suggests that rather than building separate systems for each language, the brain may rely on a shared neural mechanism for carrying out similar grammatical operations across languages. The most fascinating takeaway, perhaps, is that this shows how flexible and agile the human brain can be as it readapts and restructures existing systems in order to flex as many language muscles as necessary, that is, economical, efficient, and has potential for endless adaptability. The results suggest that the brain can reuse the same neural machinery to perform the same grammatical computation across languages, even when the words themselves are different. More broadly, this may reflect a general principle of brain organization. Whenever possible, the brain may build flexible neurosystems that can be used across different tasks rather than creating entirely separate mechanisms for each task. The more languages you speak, the slower you age. Okay, I'm adding Russian and I'm adding Polish. That's it. While Chen and Blanco Elorrieta's study did not look at the implications for cognitive training and abilities, other researchers have turned their attention to the ways in which bilingualism may help keep the brain young. Also in 2025, an international team of researchers led by Lucia Amoruso, she works at the Basque Center on Cognition, Brain, and Language in San Sebastian, Spain. They conducted cross-sectional longitudinal analyses of data from participants across 27 countries in Europe, looking at the relationship between multilingualism and biological aging. The study included over 86,000 participants using the Biobehavioral Aging Clock framework to gauge whether being able to speak more than one language could in some way help keep people younger for longer. So the study was published in Nature Aging and indicated that in country where a large part of the population was able to speak more than one language, people were 2.17 times less likely to experience accelerated aging. At the same time, monolinguals were more than twice as likely to experience early aging. Our results provide strong evidence that multilingualism functions as a protective factor for healthy aging. Language learning and use engage core brain networks related to attention, memory, and executive control, as well as social interaction, mechanisms that may reinforce resilience through life. So one of the most striking findings of the study was that the effect appeared to be cumulative. That is, the more languages a person mastered, the slower they appeared to age. The protective effect was cumulative. The more languages people spoke, the greater their protection against age-related decline. Amoroso and her colleagues did not stop here. In July 2026, that's last month, they presented, well, it's 2 months ago because you're listening in September. They presented additional research at the Federation of European Neuroscience Societies held in Barcelona, Spain. They presented a follow-up analysis conducted on data collected from a smaller subset of participants to the initial study. They looked for associations between a person's ability to speak multiple languages and brain aging. Once again, they identified positive results. The more languages a person was able to speak, the lower the difference between their brain age and their biological age. That is, multilinguals' brains stayed younger for longer. In simple terms, people who spoke more languages tend to have brains that looked younger than expected for their chronological age. The effect was not only related to the number of languages spoken, higher language proficiency and earlier acquisition of a second language were also associated with more delayed brain aging, she went on. So commenting on the study findings, Christina Dalla, PhD, who is a professor of pharmacology at the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens in Greece and chair of the FENS Forum Communication Committee, noted in their press release that the study suggests that learning a second, third, or fourth language could help our brains to stay younger for longer, and the earlier we start, the better. There are many good reasons for learning another language at any age, social, cultural, and for the health of your brain, so we should support language learning at school throughout life, even if it's hard. So bilingualism may even help protect the brain from cognitive damage following serious illness. So this was from a study from John Grundy, PhD, who's at the Experience-Related Neuroplasticity Institute in Toronto, and Melanie Pujols-Beltran from Binghamton University in New York. This study, whose findings appeared in a journal in June 2026, looked at how bilingualism might influence influence executive function, which includes processing, such as working memory. To do so, the researchers who conducted it took an example of individuals who had experienced COVID-19, severe cases of which have caused long-lasting cognitive impairment. Grundy and Pujols-Beltran asked a deceptively simple question: were bilingual people who experienced COVID-19 less likely to risk cognitive impairment in the aftermath? They analyzed data from 312 participants aged 18 to 80 years, of whom 84 were aged 18 to 29, 124 30 to 59, and 104 aged 60 and over, who self-reportedly spoke two languages. In the study, we asked whether bilingual experience might help explain why some older adults show better cognitive resilience after COVID-19 than others. We focused on executive functions, which are the mental abilities that help people manage attention, switch between tasks, hold information in mind, and respond flexibly when circumstances change. The researchers reached a heartening conclusion. Older adults who were fluent in two languages fared better from a cognitive point of view after COVID-19 than those who had lower fluency across languages. In particular, earlier and richer bilingual experience was associated with greater resilience on tasks that require flexible control of attention. Older adults with stronger bilingual experience showed less evidence of executive function disruption after COVID-19 than those with less bilingual experience. However, he cautioned that this does not suggest that bilingualism is a cure-all or a fail-proof method of keeping cognitive decline at bay. Rather, the findings suggest that bilingual experience may be one contributor to cognitive resilience out of many. Managing more than one language over many years may repeatedly exercise the systems that help the brain select relevant information, manage competing demands, and adapt attention to changing contexts. Over time, that kind of experience may help the brain maintain function when challenged by illness, aging, or other sources of cognitive stress. Grundy and Pujols-Beltran's study did not delve into the underlying biological mechanisms that might explain the link between bilingualism and a resilient brain. Still, Grundy ventured to surmise that bilingualism may remodel the brain through repeated, context-dependent demands on attention and control. Managing more than one language requires the brain to select the appropriate language, regulate competition from the other language, monitor context, and adjust behavior depending on the speaker, setting, and communicative goal. Over time, those demands may remodel the systems that support executive function. The mechanism they find most plausible is not a single bilingualism area of the brain. Rather, it's a dynamic, experience-dependent remodeling of distributed control networks, stronger communication among regions, more efficient allocation of control, and better context-sensitive shifting between effortful and more automatic processing. What matters based on the findings of the research is not just how many languages a person speaks, but how often they use them. The relevant factor may not be the number of languages alone, but how those languages are used. For example, someone who actively uses two languages every day across different contexts may experience stronger cognitive demands than someone who knows several languages but rarely uses them. Age of acquisition, proficiency, frequency of use, switching between languages and social contexts may all matter. So if you use an app like Duolingo, or you use Babbel or Rosetta Stone or whatever you're doing, and you use them to speak multiple languages and you do some exercises every day, that's going to be very good for you because you're flexing those mental muscles. When you speak multiple languages, you get more brain benefit than if you just speak your language that you learned at birth. So you want to do that as often as possible. So one easy way to do that is to use an app, because then you can use it anytime, anywhere, any day, and you're not relying on speaking that language to somebody else, to another person that you may or may not see. So the most important question is probably not simply how many languages does someone know, but how deeply, flexibly, and regularly are the languages integrated into everyday life. And mine is not going to be integrated into everyday life that well. So using Duolingo is helpful for me because I'm consistently speaking all these languages at any day that I want to. So if additional languages increase the need for flexible selection, context monitoring, and adaptive control, then they may contribute to the same kind of experience-dependent brain remodeling that we think may support resilience. So it's really interesting. So bilingual seniors have sharper brains. That's generally how it goes. So that's very interesting. So if you're worried about your cognitive health, maybe you're having some memory issues, maybe you're having some short-term memory issues, or you're having trouble formulating thoughts, one thing you may want to do is learn another language or learn a couple of other languages. And one easy way to do it is to use an app. And when you use an app, the good thing about using the app is you're on your own. You can use the app anytime and anywhere, and you can practice every day, which is going to increase your brain neuroplasticity, and you're gonna make new connections in your brain, and you're going to slow your brain aging down. And when you slow your brain aging down, your brain is holding on to a whole bunch of things, and it controls many more things. So you're actually improving your immune system because your brain controls everything. And so if you increase neuroplasticity in your cortex, everything else is going to work better too. So when you improve the functioning of one part of your body, it tends to translate to functioning in another part of your body. So that's very interesting. I think it's fun to learn languages. You know, some people will say, well, it's really hard for me. And you just have to stick with it. And some people, it's just too much trouble. They just get very frustrated. But you also have to figure out what's the best way for you to learn a language. Is it better to have somebody looking at you saying it and having you repeat after them? Maybe an app isn't good for you. Is it better for you to write stuff down? Is it better for you to use a video? People learn things differently. Some people are kinesthetic learners. Some people are oral, meaning their ears. Some people need to repeat. They need to speak and repeat things. Some people, they're good at visualizing things. So it depends on the person and how you tend to learn. The apps work fine for me. They may not for you, but I'm just saying that if you are interested in learning another language, it's going to help your memory and your cognition. It's going to help to slow down your brain aging, help to prevent dementia, and it may support your immune system as well. And it just makes you happy as long as you enjoy it. So there you go. All right. So the next thing I wanted to talk about is that those GLP-1s that everybody takes, you know, your semaglutide and your tirzepatide, they can cause hair loss. So I wanted to talk about how they cause hair loss and what you do about it. So GLP-1s like your Ozempic, your Wegovy, your Mounjaro, and your Zepbound, they may increase the risk of hair loss, and it's non-scarring alopecia, thank goodness. If it was scarring alopecia, when you get scarring alopecia, that means that you get scar tissue on your follicles and the follicles can't grow hair again. But so if it's non-scarring, you can get hair back. So it's typically non-permanent, and it was more common among GLP-1 users than those who took SGLT2 inhibitors or DPP-4 inhibitors for the treatment of type 2 diabetes. And I have patients who take a number of those. I'm not sure which drugs are the SGLT2 and DPP-4, but I know I've looked them up before when you know, because you have your Jardiance and your empagliflozin, and I'm not sure which is the SGLT2 and which is the DPP-4, but the GLP-1s, they're so many people are interested in them, so many people take them that I'm familiar with what they are and which ones they are. The absolute risk of hair loss may be low, but raising awareness can help people make informed decisions about the treatment plan. So there was a new large-scale study that found that people with type 2 diabetes who are taking GLP-1 medications may have a higher risk of hair loss. So there was research published in the British Medical Journal that compared the risk of alopecia, which is a form of hair loss, among adults who took either GLP-1s, SGLT2 inhibitors, or DPP-4 inhibitors for the treatment of diabetes. There was an increased risk of non-scarring alopecia, which is typically a temporary or reversible type of hair loss, which can include telogen effluvium and androgenetic alopecia. While the researchers suggest that absolute risk of hair loss with GLP-1 medications is low, understanding the potential for alopecia may help inform treatment decisions among patients. GLP-1s is linked up to 68% higher hair loss risk. So GLP-1 use in adults with type 2 diabetes was associated with a higher risk of clinically recorded non-scarring alopecia, a type of hair loss that does not permanently damage the hair follicles. Researchers examined electronic health records data from the University of Pennsylvania Health System, that's Penn Medicine, between January 2019 and September of 2024. They looked at the EHR record data from over 12,000 GLP-1 users and over 15,000 SGLT2 inhibitors, in the GLP-1 versus SGLT cohort. In the GLP-1 versus DPP-4 cohort, they focused on data from almost 12,000 GLP-1 users and 11,000 DPP-4. Compared with adults taking SGLT2 inhibitors, those taking GLP-1 medication, compared with adults taking SGLT2 inhibitors, those taking GLP-1 medication to treat diabetes had a 37% higher chance of experiencing hair loss. The findings suggest that GLP-1s were associated with a higher risk of hair loss than two alternative diabetes treatments, but do not establish the hair loss risk in people taking GLP-1s for non-diabetes purposes. The findings regarding the increased risk of alopecia, comparing the SGLT2 inhibitors and DPP-4 inhibitors, are notable, though not entirely surprising, given that significant weight loss by any means can result in hair loss. Dr. Ali, who is a bariatric surgeon and bariatric specialist, and the medication acts as a catalyst for weight loss, but the resulting physiological stress and hormonal changes are often the direct trigger for telogen effluvium. So telogen effluvium is where your hair cycle gets interrupted. So you have a normal cycle. You have a hair that grows in your head. It grows out to the length that you normally get to, whatever that is. Here's mine if you're looking at the Facebook Live. It grows, your hair will grow out to that length. It'll sit around for a while at that length and then it'll fall out. And then you'll grow a new one in that follicle, you hope. And so what happens with telogen effluvium is your hair growth cycle gets interrupted. So you hold on to lots of hair and it doesn't do its falling out thing and your hair gets kind of thicker. And then all of a sudden a whole bunch of it will fall out at once. It's just that the cycle got interrupted. It's not that you technically have less hair growth. It's just that you had stress. So the cycle was interrupted. That's telogen effluvium and there's no scarring associated with telogen effluvium. The latest research is an observational study, so it can't confirm whether any specific factor directly causes another, so it can't determine that the weight loss and nutritional deficiencies definitely led to hair loss. The research did note a possible link. Telogen effluvium is already associated with weight loss, and the rapid weight loss associated with GLP-1 could also lead to non-scarring alopecia. In reducing calories, some people taking GLP-1 drugs may develop certain nutritional deficiencies, which can affect how hair grows. The study authors suggest that deficiencies in biotin, iron, and zinc can also contribute to hair loss. So the doctors recommend that you want to ensure patients maintain adequate protein intake and supplement appropriately with key micronutrients, especially iron, zinc, and biotin, while on the medications. And routine monitoring should include checking basic nutritional labs if hair loss becomes a concern. So the problem, what's the problem? So you want people on GLP-1s to eat more protein, and they do have to really make sure they eat protein, because people on GLP-1s don't just lose weight from their, they don't just lose fat weight. They also lose muscle mass. They lose lean weight too. So they lose muscle mass. They lose lean tissue weight. They lose bone weight. And so in order to mitigate that, whether you're using a GLP-1 or not, you're supposed to eat extra protein. And the problem is, when you're on a GLP-1, it reduces your appetite. So you may not be able to eat the protein. You may not be able to keep up because you just can't do it. You just don't have the appetite to eat. And so people get nutritional deficiencies. And taking a protein supplement is difficult because protein supplements take up space and have calories. And if you don't have the appetite, taking a protein shake can be hard to do. You can take supplements of biotin, iron, and zinc. Those are easy because they can be little tablets or capsules or drops. But to get the protein in, it's really hard to do. It's one of my concerns about GLP-1s, that in order to maintain your lean tissue, which is what you ultimately want to do, it's very hard to do because you don't have the appetite, because it turns off the food noise. It reduces your appetite. Other factors that may contribute to hair loss in people taking GLP-1 medications include changes in thyroid function and altered absorption of oral drugs, such as thyroid hormone or sex hormone medications, due to delayed gastric emptying. That's right, that you get delayed gastric emptying. That's why me, if you are on a GLP-1 and you're taking it and you're happy, more power to you. I think that's fine. Personally, I don't want to go near it. I don't want anything interfering with the normal functioning of my digestive system, because my digestive system works pretty well. I would rather try to figure out how to be at a healthy weight without using a GLP-1. But that's me, and I don't judge people if they want to take GLP-1s. I just help them weigh the pros and cons and explain to them about eating the extra protein and monitoring for nutritional deficiencies, and making sure that because they don't have a big appetite, that when they do eat, they eat good stuff. So could awareness inform patient decision-making? Around 6 or 7 of every 1,000 people taking GLP-1 medications experience, so that's not a huge amount, they experience hair loss each year. With the absolute risk of hair loss with GLP-1s, the risk is low. It's necessary for people to be aware of the possibility so they can weigh the benefits of the treatment against the risk and make an informed decision. So Dr. Mittal, who's a hair transplant surgeon at Mittal Hair Clinic, was not involved in the study, explained that the vast majority of patients will never experience clinically significant hair loss, but the study reinforces that shedding can occur in a small proportion of people and is something clinicians should discuss before treatment. Thus, individuals taking GLP-1 medications for type 2 diabetes should be aware of all options available to them, which can include SGLT2 inhibitors and DPP-4 inhibitors, depending on individual circumstances. So this is GLP-1 for diabetes as opposed to weight loss. You don't take the SGLT2s and the DPP-4s for weight loss. It's particularly important for people to be aware of the risk of hair loss in cases where they already have an increased risk of alopecia. There was further emphasis that the benefit of taking GLP-1s as prescribed usually outweighs the risks. For the vast majority of patients seeking treatment for obesity in adults, the metabolic benefits of GLP-1 significantly outweighs the risk of temporary non-scarring hair loss, which usually resolves once weight stabilizes. Groups who might be more at risk for hair loss are those with pre-existing nutritional deficiencies or those experiencing very rapid significant weight loss. People who lose weight very rapidly, have pre-existing nutritional deficiencies, women with low iron stores, individuals recovering from bariatric surgery, or those with underlying androgenetic hair loss may notice shedding more readily. Androgenetic hair loss is pattern balding, which can happen in men, or it happens more often in men, but it can also happen in women. They may notice shedding more readily because they've already got reduced hair. So how do you manage hair loss when you're taking GLP-1s? You should work closely with a healthcare professional who can help you manage your hair loss or monitor for any changes when taking GLP-1 medications. And Dr. Opal Baker, who's a general practitioner at the Mayfield Clinic in the UK, was not involved in this mentioned study, had some advice. And the most important advice is not to panic and not to discontinue treatment without medical advice. We encourage patients to lose weight at a sustainable pace rather than as quickly as possible, and prioritize adequate protein intake and attend regular follow-up appointments. If hair shedding develops, it's sensible to assess dietary intake and, where clinically indicated, arrange blood tests to check for iron deficiency, thyroid disease, vitamin B12, or other contributing factors. Monitoring is straightforward and can form part of routine reviews. Some general tips for managing non-scarring alopecia include limiting the use of heated hair tools, such as hair dryers, as well as hair bleaching, following a balanced diet favoring foods rich in iron and protein, and stop smoking if you're smoking. Patients shouldn't stop treatment because they're worried about hair loss alone. Instead, they should focus on prevention. Maintaining adequate protein intake, avoiding excessive calorie restriction, and ensuring sufficient iron, zinc, and other micronutrients can make a significant difference. If someone notices increased shedding, particularly after 3 to 6 months, they should seek assessment early rather than assuming it's permanent. A specialist can identify whether this is temporary telogen effluvium or an unrelated condition requiring treatment. So there you go. So who knew? The GLP-1s, if you're taking GLP-1s, they can increase, the study was done on people taking GLP-1s to control diabetes, but people will notice hair loss even if they're not taking it for diabetes, if they're just taking it for weight loss. And it's the rapid weight loss, it's the hormonal shifts that cause the rapid weight loss, and possibly also nutritional deficiencies that are causing the hair loss, because you're just not as likely to eat enough. And if you're not taking enough, and if you're not supplementing with things like iron, protein and zinc, you may be more likely to lose hair. Like I said, GLP-1s are not for me. If they are for you, you can talk to me about how to manage your GLP-1s, how to be healthier while taking your GLP-1s. That's something I do support patients in doing, because I obviously I'm going to have patients taking GLP-1s, because lots of people are. So very interesting. All right. So we don't have a lot of time left. So we only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to just talk about some things in general. It's really hot outside. We're in a heat wave right now, so just be really careful out there. It's not a great idea to get really intense exercise during a heat wave when it's really hot and it's really steamy out, unless you're very, very well acclimated to it. And most people aren't. It's just not worth it. It's just not worth the risk. If you need to exercise intensely outdoors, it's a really good idea to do it early in the morning when the heat hasn't come up and the humidity hasn't come up. It's time to get up a little bit earlier and get that workout done outdoors early. And if you can't manage to do that, it's probably a good idea to just exercise indoors. I used to be much more heat tolerant, but this summer I've had issues because I have times when my back is hurting, or my knee or my leg, and I went through Lyme disease. So what usually happens is when I'm on the bike over the course of the summer, I acclimate to the heat. But if I'm on and off the bike and I'm not outside, my acclimation doesn't happen as quickly. I'm pretty well acclimated now, but I'm looking at Saturday, the next time that I'm planning to ride, and it feels like it's going to be nearly 90 degrees at like 9 o'clock, and that doesn't sound like fun to me. So what I may do is ride very short, starting in the 8 o'clock hour, and just not stay out very long in it. Make sure to hydrate when I get back. If you are out in the heat, obviously you want to hydrate, and that's a good time. If you're sweating, the problem with being outside sweating when it's very humid is the way your body cools off is to sweat, and then you cool off because the sweat evaporates and is carried away by the air. If the air is saturated with water, there's nowhere for the sweat to go. So you're sweating out, your sweat is ineffective, and it's not effective at cooling your body down. And that not cooling your body down can turn out to be dangerous. You can get into a heat exhaustion situation. And it can even progress to heat stroke. So just be really, really careful out there. Maybe when it's super hot out, it's a good day to go for a gentle walk and then think about getting in water, going to the beach, going to the lake, going into a pool, or just exercising indoors. But if you can get in and out of water, that's a way to be outside without where you have a way to cool off. I love to be in water, especially in natural bodies of water this time of year. So I will probably do that in the next few days. So be aware of that. And water with electrolytes. Remember, electrolytes can be very simply. You can fill up a container a quarter of the way with your favorite fruit juice, a pinch or two of sea salt, or, you know, Himalayan salt or whatever kind of salt you got, and then fill it the rest of the way with water, and that can be your electrolyte. You can get all kinds of electrolyte products with varying levels of salt. If you're going to be sweating a lot, you want the salt content of your electrolyte to be higher. And be careful of prepared electrolyte drinks that you get in the convenience store or the supermarket. Just make sure that they don't have a lot of junk in them. I'm not a big fan of electrolytes that have artificial sweeteners in it or that have excessive sugar. Medium sugar, I think, is okay because sugar does help you draw water into your cells. Salt and sugar help you to absorb water faster than plain water alone. Which is why if you're out sweating and exercising in very hot weather where it's humid, that it's a good idea to use electrolytes. So that's my admonishment for the day. And I think at this point, I will let you go. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores and WHUS.org. Thank you so much for listening.